Yeah, welcome back to the lecture. Last week, we looked at definitions. So the big goal was to understand how definitions work and understand how far they are systematic and how far there is a methodology. So system and method. We had that in the tutorial a second ago, but just to keep that also for the lecture on record, such a definition consists of five steps. The first one is defining the syntax, inputs and outputs of the algorithms, and just basically specifying the algorithms. The second step is correctness. So specifying what type of functionality we expect when there is no adversary that tries to change anything or be malicious. We just look at, in an honest execution, what type of input and output behavior do we expect. The third step is to specify for an adversary which type of capabilities it has. So which strength, which power, how far can the adversary control what the victims are doing? So for encryption, we just saw that we want to model that an adversary can let the victims choose particular messages, because as I said, messages do not typically just contain free bits that the adversary can choose, but rather that the victims can choose, but rather there is padding that is added to the message. There is a certain encoding scheme that is used by the victims that they can't choose by themselves. And the messages that they send are not full of entropy, but they basically are context dependent. And so in order to model all those things, we basically let the adversary choose which messages are encrypted or signed or MAC'd or whatever. And so this is one of the ways to capture that an adversary should, we should consider adversaries as strong as possible to say something meaningful about the security of constructions that are executed in such environments in which we have strong adversaries. The fourth step is to specify what the adversary's goal is. So for encryption, it is typically breaking confidentiality. Confidentiality is typically modeled via indistinguishability of ciphertexts or one-way security, meaning that the adversary cannot extract the full message of a ciphertext or the full key of a chem ciphertext, and so on and so forth. In the exercise, we saw two different types of definitions for primitives that protect authenticity and integrity. So for signatures and for message authentication codes, we have the capabilities that the adversaries can choose messages arbitrarily. So this is the reason why those definitions have CMA, so chosen message attacks, as capability specification. And we have a different goal. The adversary does not want to find out which message is encrypted in a ciphertext or which key, but rather which the adversary has to come up with a forgery for a tag, for a signature, and so on. And so these definitions have the name strong unforgeability or existential unforgeability. We talked about the differences in the exercise. And the fifth step is, at least for me, sometimes the most interesting one, because it challenges yourself to find all the trivial attacks. Trivial attacks is the one that we're talking about, trivial attacks. And those attacks are trivial because they work against every construction that is correct. So as long as a construction is correct, we can basically determine from syntax, correctness, capabilities, and the goal how an adversary can break the goal without using any properties of the construction. Because these trivial attacks, they are independent of the construction. They don't need any specification of how the construction work. They work against every construction and they work generically. And so typically we can find these trivial attacks without having any construction in mind. They work against every correct construction. And so once we removed all these trivial attacks from our definition, we forbid these trivial attacks. The only way the attacker can win is to try to attack the actual construction that we are analyzing. And our hope is, and sometimes this works, I think in most of the cases it works, that if we have a definition that captures a meaningful goal, captures or models meaningful adversary capabilities for a useful syntax and correctness definition, and we then ruled out all the trivial attacks that are determined by all these prior four steps, then we come up with a definition that can be satisfied by a construction. The reason why I'm saying this is not always the case is that these definitions are very strong. They can be considered as the strongest definitions that we can hope for, because they restrict the adversary only regarding trivial attacks. There are definitions that people think about and come up from intuitive ideas of what security should mean, and those definitions are typically much weaker, because they do not only restrict the adversaries for the trivial attacks, but they restrict them much more. One of the examples for such a definition is the RCCA definition that we had today in the exercise. It restricts the adversary more than necessary. And so we can come up with simpler constructions, more efficient constructions, and also the same basically for existential versus strong unforgeability. Strong unforgeability is a stronger goal, and so the constructions are also typically less efficient. Strong unforgeability has a trivial or excludes the smallest set of possible trivial attacks. Existential unforgeability excludes more attacks than only the trivial ones. And there are definitions or there are primitives for which we can specify 1, 2, 3, 4, and then just determine trivial attacks, and then we come up with a definition that is super hard to instantiate with a construction. We will see this for building blocks in the messaging setting, for which it is super hard, or for which the constructions are super inefficient. Still, these constructions are super secure, but they are more than necessary secure. So no messenger will implement them, because we know that in order to build them, we need building blocks that are super inefficient. And so we have these strong definitions, but sometimes we restrict the adversary more than necessary with respect to these trivial attacks, because sometimes these definitions, as I said, are too strong. So if So as I said, this yields the strongest definition with respect to the four steps before that. Okay. So we did this last week for CAMS. And we did this for indistinguishability versus one-way security. And we did this for CPA versus CCA security. And today, we added to this our CCA security. Okay, today, we talk about forward security. We talk about a construction. that uses hierarchical identity-based encryption. Fancy name, pretty complex. And we will maybe look at how to bypass the use for such super or slightly inefficient building blocks by introducing interaction to achieve forward security. Are there any questions so far? Because otherwise we will just jump into the topic. Forward security. So the basic idea for forward security is we have Alice and Bob. Alice sends a ciphertext. I think I have to fix the microphone a little bit. Okay. So, we have Alice and Bob. Alice sends a ciphertext to Bob. And maybe we have then Dave sending a ciphertext to Bob. And maybe at some point we have Eve sending a ciphertext to Bob. And then at some point, the secret key of Bob is leaked. Still, Bob might continue to communicate. So there is some, I don't know, Francis sending another ciphertext to Bob. If we think about the key encapsulation mechanism setting from last week, all the keys that are established with the first three and the fourth ciphertext become insecure once the secret key of Bob is corrupted, is leaked, is given to the attacker, is exposed. These are all names for the same idea that an attacker somehow obtains access to the secret key. But with forward security, we want that this stays secure. Whereas as soon as the secret key is given to the attacker, things cannot be secure anymore, at least for a correct scheme. So I guess most of you have heard of the term forward security, and forward security has super different meanings for different primitives. We will look at forward secure key encapsulation mechanisms today. So we've learned about this primitive last week already. The syntax remains the same. We have a chem that consists of three algorithms, gen, eng, and dec. But these three algorithms are now slightly different. Still, and I just slightly shifted from using secret key instead of decryption key, but I guess this all makes sense for you. The only reason for using decryption key instead of secret key is that sometimes we use signatures and public key encryption, or signatures and chems, in the same construction. And then what we want to do is we want to distinguish which type of keys are used for what. And so we use signing key SK and verification key VK for the signature part, and encryption key EK for, and decryption key DK for the chem or the public key encryption scheme. Okay, so just as last week, Bob generates a secret key public key pair. Alice uses the encryption algorithm together with the public key to come up with a key that is encapsulated in the ciphertext. And now the ciphertext is given to Bob. And last week, the decryption algorithm looked as follows, or decapsulation algorithm looked as follows. Key is output by the decapsulation algorithm with the secret key and the ciphertext. Can we achieve forward security with this primitive? Or if not, why not? For a correct scheme, yeah. Because the decryption or the decapsulation algorithm is deterministic. And so it will do the same for every ciphertext whenever the same decapsulation algorithm is executed. And so it doesn't depend on, or there is no change. If ciphertexts have ever been produced and you know the secret key, you can use the secret key whenever you want to, will always output the same key that was encapsulated. And so this is not the specification of the decapsulation algorithm that we look at today. Instead, we slightly modify it. Does anybody have an idea how we can modify it in order to get a scheme that can offer forward security?
Mm-hmm. So if it gives us a new secret key that we can use for the next decapsulation, so that every time the decapsulation will change, and the attacker would only have like the newest secret key and not the old ones.
Beautiful. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the idea is to always change the secret key. Once we decapsulated one ciphertext, we will do something to the secret key such that decapsulating the same ciphertext again will never work again. So we have to remove some information from the secret key. This is the abstract idea. And the basic prim or the basic properties are that, first of all, this secret key here, by correctness, is able to decapsulate the ciphertext, whereas this secret key, by security, should not reveal any information about the key that is decapsulated from C. So, correctness says this one should do this, and security will say the secret key that is output from the decapsulation should not reveal anything on the key that has just been decapsulated. Fantastic. Okay. Speaking of correctness, let's specify correctness. And this might be the first time that we see already that a definition of correctness is much more compact and easier to understand if we write it down with these oracles, and instead of writing down this probability definition. Okay. So our game is doing some bookkeeping that we will add in a second. And it starts effectively by generating a fresh ChemKey pair. We invoke the adversary with input of the public key. And we stop with zero if everything works out. The encapsulation algorithm internally executes the encapsulation algorithm. Doing some bookkeeping and returns the ciphertext. The decapsulation oracle also internally just executes the decapsulation algorithm. Then we will add our condition for when things are correct. We do some bookkeeping and return the final key. So the basic idea of the bookkeeping is that we memorize for each ciphertext which key is encapsulated in it. So we have an oracle, an array that we initialize with the bot symbol, and then for every encapsulation that we perform, we store in this array at the entry C the key that has just been encapsulated. And now our property that we want to capture is that decapsulation succeeds. So if decapsulation does not succeed, we basically see that the key that is computed differs from the key that we store if we stored it already. So we have to digest this for a second. So we store every time we encapsulate for the ciphertext which key should be decapsulated. So this is basically just the functionality array. We store along every ciphertext that we produce which key should be decapsulated from that ciphertext. And if the decapsulation oracle is executed, we check, has this ciphertext been produced by the encapsulation algorithm? So we check that it has actually been set from bot to a real key. So if this thing is filled, but it differs from the key that the decapsulation algorithm output, then this thing is not correct. This is just the same as for normal key encapsulation mechanisms. There is one thing missing here, which you see, because there is still a bullet point. So what is missing here? In order to capture what we intuitively meant. To give you a hint, so I want you, everybody, to wake up now. I want to see at least two fingers, maybe even three, seeing what I can do. Everybody wake up. So far, we just require the same thing as we would require for, maybe the problem could be with the microphone that I'm always touching my pockets. So far, we just require the same thing as for normal key encapsulation mechanisms. But this is too strong. This is too strong. Our forward secure CAM cannot achieve the same correctness guarantees as a normal CAM. Because for security, we actually want that sometimes it will not work. In some cases, correctness should not hold. Because security asks us to protect certain things. Okay, two fingers. Waiting for the third one. Everybody wake up. To increase the pressure, if I don't see three fingers, I will ask one of the others who didn't raise their hands what the problem is. So, correctness says, if things haven't been decapsulated yet, things should be decapsulatable. But security says, as soon as this happens, as soon as things have been decapsulated, there should not be information on key stored in the secret key anymore. What does that mean for correctness? So far we require that if a key has been encapsulated in a ciphertext due to the encapsulation oracle being queried, then the decapsulation algorithm inside the decapsulation oracle should produce exactly the same key as it was encapsulated on the encapsulation side. But security says there should be no information on K in the secret key as soon as the key has been decapsulated once.
Oh, so you need to make sure that the new secret key is different from the initial secret key?
What we typically do in correctness definitions is we just focus really just on the correctness. And the same also holds for security. We try to really just focus on what it means for correctness. Effectively, the secret key will be different, but this will be enforced by the conditions that we ask. Do you have an idea?
Me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now, I mean, it's kind of a popular attack also, you could say, because one could call two times the decryption, the decapsulation oracle the same ciphertext.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time it will just return a key.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time, because now the secret key changed and it has no longer information to decapsulate the key, it will stop with one and the adversary will win the game.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So, the missing language just have to delete the key out of our dictionary.
Yeah. Exactly. Interesting way to think about it. Yeah, it's basically a trivia tech. Interesting conceptual thinking. So, the idea is, as soon as things have been decapsulated, we don't require that things can be decapsulated a second time. And for that reason, we basically jump into this initial state in which we haven't encapsulated to that ciphertext ever before. And by the randomness that is included in generating new ciphertexts, this will not happen again. And so things should work out at the end for schemes that are also secure. Okay, so this is the idea. We just require correctness for one decapsulation, we don't require it for a second decapsulation again. Very good. And so, basically, correctness means that the probability of the correctness game for the chem construction with A outputting 0 is 1. Okay. Security. For security, we again specify a game. And this is the IND CCA game, almost the same as we specified it last week for normal chems. So we again have the challenge oracle. we have a decapsulation oracle. And we will see a fourth oracle in a second. So we do bookkeeping as always. And the first interesting part is that we generate a key pair. And then, as we are used to for indistinguishability games, we let the adversary on input of the public key output a bit. And this bit effectively says, hi, I'm the adversary, and either I'm this or that version of the game. Also in the challenge oracle, we do some bookkeeping. And after this, we execute the encapsulation algorithm on the public key, which outputs the real key and the ciphertext. And as in the normal NCCA game, the key K1 is randomly sampled from the set of all keys. We do some final bookkeeping and then eventually return the challenge key and the challenge ciphertext. The decryption or the decapsulation oracle begins with executing the decapsulation. Which in this case has the input secret key ciphertext and outputs a new secret key and a new key. Then we have some bookkeeping and some conditions that are checked. And eventually we return the key. So we will first start with the things that we've seen last week already, for which we make sure that the decapsulation oracle does not reveal trivial information or information that suffices to break the challenges. And so we basically memorize all the ciphertexts that have been output by the challenge oracle. So if the ciphertext that is queried to the decapsulation oracle has been queried already to the challenge oracle, so we keep a set of all ciphertexts that have been queried or output by the challenge oracle, and if the decapsulation input is a ciphertext that was a challenge, then we don't return the output. Now the first step is to see that due to our slightly weakened correctness definition, we can also slightly strengthen the security definition by changing something So our challenge oracle produces challenge ciphertexts. And our decapsulation oracle returns the keys from these challenge ciphertexts, from all ciphertexts, unless these ciphertexts are challenge ciphertexts. But we mute these keys of challenge ciphertexts only. Still, we let the decapsulation algorithm being executed on them. So a reminder, our correctness definition only requires the decapsulation oracle to output the correct key once. As soon as this happened, we erase this entry in the array, and so the same ciphertext is input to this oracle again. We don't expect that the key here is output again. Now think about the challenge ciphertext being input to the decapsulation oracle again. The decapsulation algorithm is executed. If this is a challenge ciphertext, we mute the output, but still we let the decapsulation algorithm run and the secret key being updated. How can we strengthen this definition? A reminder, the decapsulation algorithm with one secret key and the ciphertext will lead to the secret key having no information stored about the key anymore after it was executed once. This is our basic idea. Our basic idea is with every decapsulation, we forget information. We forget information about the things that we just decapsulated. So this secret key only has enough information to decapsulate future ciphertexts, but not those that have been decapsulated already. And so our correctness definition, just requires that a ciphertext, when it is produced by the encapsulation oracle due to the encapsulation algorithm, then this ciphertext must produce the exact same key for the decapsulation if it is executed for the first time. So after it was executed for the first time, we remove this entry from this array here, and so this this equation here does not need to hold anymore because KC equals spot, and so we don't fall into this case again. In our security game, we have a set of ciphertexts that are challenges. They are produced in the challenge oracle from the encapsulation algorithm. We store these ciphertexts to make sure that if they are queried to the decapsulation oracle, then of course the output, this key here, would solve the challenge. And so we make sure that if this ciphertext is a challenge ciphertext, we don't give back the actual key. We just give back a mute symbol to say this is a challenge ciphertext.
Can we delete the ciphertext, the challenge ciphertext, because we don't have key anymore?
So what would you write here? We just remove the challenge or the ciphertext that we just received here from the set of the challenge ciphertext, because it was decapsulated once now, and now after this, it cannot produce or should not produce any information on that key anymore. Okay, so this was the first step. There is a slightly more interesting step now, because we add a fourth oracle. And this oracle captures what we actually want to have for forward security. Our threat, our attacker. Our attacker is someone who can access the secret key. So the attacker can do this here. The attacker can access the secret key at some point. And before we write down what the attacker can do here, maybe let's collect a couple of reasons why this is a good idea to capture this, to model this, to allow an attacker at some point to corrupt, to obtain information on the secret key. Let's just collect a couple of threats from the real world that model this. Why do we need forward security? Why is this relevant? Or when does an attacker have access to the secret key of a victim? Virus. Confiscated by police, stolen. What else? Very good points, thanks.
I have a question.
Sure.
For example, your phone is confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would leak the secret key, but it would also leak all the previous decapsulated keys or not.
The idea is that you remove them after you use them. Yes. This is typically the setting in which we are. So if you think that a message was super valuable, or I don't know, if anybody who would read that information would learn something about you that you shouldn't want or that you don't want to, you remove your message. That's the reason why these messengers have the ability to delete or to view messages once, to delete them after a certain while. There are these features in Signal, I think, in WhatsApp, and also in the web context. So this is just the messaging context, which is great. I think it's great that you're motivated by this, because this is the actual goal of this lecture. But such secret keys are also used on the internet. So Amazon or Wikipedia or whatever. You go to a website, you send them information, you establish a key, and what you want afterwards is that after your key exchange or after your session, is done, even if the secret key, the long-term secret key of Wikipedia is ever leaked to anybody, they should not learn anything about you, even if they recorded all the transcript of all the communication that has ever happened. And so TLS, that protects our internet, that protects Wikipedia, Amazon, and so on, has mandatory forward security in TLS 1.3 at least, except for the European weird standardized version of TLS. But the normal TLS, so not ETLS, but the normal TLS always offers forward security if you use it in the newest version. And of course, the techniques that are used there are different from these CAN types. And also these CAN types here are, I think, never really implemented in the real world, because we will see in our construction in a couple of seconds that the building block that we use in order to achieve this level of forward security is rather inefficient, but I want you to keep in mind that forward security is essential. We want to have it in all the protocols. And forward secure CAMs are interesting, but they are not practical yet. Not super practical. At least not that practical that we would like to use them in normal messaging or in normal key exchange. There are situations, for example, if you want to, I don't know, communicate with your satellites, and it's important that you don't have a round trip in order to send information. You just want to send a ciphertext to your satellite. You want to send it once. It should be compact. It should be small. It should just go there without waiting for a response or anything. Then those type of cams can be interesting. Because you just send things once. The satellite internally is doing some stuff such that forward security is achieved. And then if at some point your satellite secret key is corrupted, because I don't know, your opponent's astronauts get access, physical access to your secret key or whatever, then you achieve forward security. Okay, so this is roughly the setting. Or you could also think about it vice versa. Your satellite has a public key and you send your stuff to your base station, and at some point the secret key on your base station is corrupted, but you don't want to have interaction. Then forward secure cams are the things that you want. Okay, so virus, confiscated, things are stolen. We will see more motivating examples for why forward security is important or why secret key corruption can happen for other settings. But this is important to keep in mind. And so in order to capture this in our security definition, we have an additional oracle. And this oracle is typically called corrupt because it corrupts the secret key. And so we have, again, bookkeeping things. But the actual idea of this oracle is to return the secret key. And now we have new trivial attacks. Anybody sees a trivial attack here that we want to prevent? And there are basically two of them.
Mm-hmm. One is to just instantly get the secret key and use it to decipher a challenge.
And the simple idea of how to prevent this, very good, thank you. The simple way to forbid this trivial attack is to just keep track of whether the corruption has happened already. Mm-hmm. This is not captured here, exactly. So what would the trivial attack look like? Exactly. So how could we forbid this or prevent this? Perfect. Very, very good. So at the end, our advantage is just the same as it was for normal chems. The probability that the NCCA gain for the chem when being parameterized with challenge bit 0 for an adversary equals 1 minus the same probability except for challenge bit b equals 0 equals 1. And this the absolute. Okay, so this is our definition, and now we look at how to build this thing. And so we call this thing forward secure cam. And the main interesting part is to understand how the major building block that we use for this looks like. And this building block is called hierarchical identity-based encryption. So in German, hierarchisches identitätsbasierte Verschlüsselung. And we will understand what this hierarchy is in a second. HIBE. And you should remember this hierarchical identity-based encryption thing, ideally until the end of our course, because we will see it in a slightly different form, used for a slightly different purpose again. It's a very strong and versatile and useful primitive. The only problem is all the constructions that we know for hierarchical identity-based encryption are rather inefficient. Inefficient in a sense that we can use them if we send a message once every 2 minutes, or we don't send things in all of the sessions that we use for messaging. But we could use this, as I said, if we send a message once every minute or so. It's an interesting concept. And so HIBE is a tuple of four algorithms, gen, eng, deck, and delegate. Generate, encapsulate, decapsulate, delegate. So actually we're talking about hierarchical identity-based CAM and not encryption. But everybody calls it HIBE. And so for a second, we forget that we want to use it for this forward secure CAM thing. We just try to focus on hierarchical identity-based encryption and the use case, without thinking about forward security and all the things that we discussed so far, because it's super interesting and a useful building block. Okay, the basic idea is that we have Alice and some other parties. And we will talk about the other parties in a second. The basic idea of Alice is that she wants to encapsulate key and ciphertext within an encapsulation algorithm. But her biggest problem is she knows a public key from some super high hierarchy, but not of the receiver that she wants to talk to. So let's think of the domain name system. And at the top of the German domain name system, we have the DENIC that makes sure that for all the .de websites, the certificates are handled correctly, and we have a large domain name system for which we can make sure things work. Okay. But Alice doesn't want to talk to the DENIC. But the DENIC, so the top-level domain, is the one who generates the initial secret key public key pair. But Alice doesn't want to talk to the DENIC. Alice wants to talk to Bob. And the only thing that she knows about Bob is Bob's email address. And Bob works at the group that I work for too, the chair of applied cryptography, which belongs to the technical faculty of the FAU in Germany. So this is the email address. And you see here there is a certain hierarchy in this setting. So Bob works at a chair. This chair belongs to a faculty. This faculty belongs to a university. And this university is in Germany. And so she hopes that if she sends this thing, this ciphertext, to this email address, then the only one who can decapsulate the ciphertext is Bob. Okay, so the Danik makes sure that for all the websites registered in Germany, things work correctly. In particular, she makes sure that my previous university in Bochum, the Ruhr University in Bochum, can host their website, my personal website works. And also the website of the FAU works. And what the Danik is doing for this is she's using the delegation algorithm. So the delegation algorithm produces delegated secret keys. So especially for the FAU, she's generating the secret key prime that is delegated from the original secret key and the string FAU. Now the FAU has multiple faculties. Unfortunately, I don't know which of them, but I at least know that there is the technical faculty. Let's think that there is a medical faculty too, so don't know what their domain is, but let's think of it as medical.fau.de. And there is, of course, the technical faculty of fau.de. And now the administrator of the technical faculty, no, the administrator of the FAU knows the secret key SK prime. And for the technical faculty, the administrator of the entire FAU is delegating another secret key with the string TF for the technical faculty. And this can go on further and further. This is a huge tree. A huge tree of a hierarchy basically looks the same as the domain name system, but just with email addresses. And then at the end, we have Bob, who has the email address bob@thechairofappliedcryptography.tf.fau.de. And the administrator of the chair for applied cryptography makes sure that Bob receives secret key with 4. Four primes, which is delegated from a secret key just one step higher in the hierarchy together with the string Bob. And I'm using email and the domain name system here because it's one of the simplest to explain to informatics students because it's very super hierarchical. But there are many other systems that you can structure in such a hierarchy for which it would make sense to delegate secret keys. And so once Bob knows his secret key, he can use the decapsulation algorithm with his secret key and the ciphertext to obtain back the key. This is the basic idea. So more clearly, the syntax is that we have a gen algorithm that, as always, probabilistically generates a secret key and a public key. We have an encapsulation algorithm that takes a public key as well as a bit string of length L times lambda and outputs a key and a ciphertext. Where L is a natural number and lambda is also a natural number. Which is the string length per delegation. The decapsulation algorithm is just the way it was before. It takes a secret key and a ciphertext and outputs a key. And the delegation algorithm takes a secret key and a bit string of length lambda and outputs a new secret key again. We won't formally use HIBE and I won't write a proof or anything. And for that reason, I just sketched the correctness and security guarantees on a high level to get you a feeling for it. So the correctness guarantee is pretty straightforward. The encapsulation algorithm produces a ciphertext when it is directed to the main public key and an identity string. And we want that the secret key that is delegated for this exact identity string via this delegation path here, that this secret key is able to decapsulate the ciphertext to obtain the same key. This makes sense, right? So it's just, we basically replace the atomic public key with a public key and an identity string, and if the public key with that identity string produces a ciphertext, then the secret key that is delegated for this exact identity string should be able to decapsulate the ciphertext to obtain the same key. Okay, let's write that down. So, roughly it means that the secret key delegated to string ID equals ID 1, ID L, can decapsulate C if K, C is the result of the encapsulation to the public key and that ID. And we could formalize this even further, but I think the intuition becomes clear. Now for security, what we want is that nobody else than Bob, with his secret key, can decapsulate the ciphertext. But, of course, Bob is not the only one who can access this secret key. So, for example, the Denik knows the main secret key. So the Denik can delegate in all directions to obtain Bob's secret key. But the major property is that we trust everyone on the path from our own identity up to the root. We don't want to trust anyone else, but we have to trust anyone on the path from our own node to the root. So Bob, as a user of the, or as a user at the FAU, doesn't need to trust any admin that works at the university in Bochum. And Bob doesn't also need to trust anyone who is assigned to a domain on my website. Also, Bob, as I said, has to trust people at the tech fac, but Bob doesn't have to trust anyone at the medical faculty. So any admin working at the medical faculty shouldn't be able to obtain information on Bob's emails. But again, anyone working at the chair for applied, no, the administrator working at the chair for applied cryptography knows the secret key for delegating Bob's key. But all my colleagues working at, or all Bob's colleagues working at the same group who are not administrators should not be able to obtain information on the emails sent to Bob. So the basic security guarantee is that K is indistinguishable from a random key, with KC equals the encapsulation of public key and an identity string. As long as none of the secret keys delegated to prefixes of this identity string are corrupted. Just to clarify this again, we have an encapsulation algorithm that outputs on public key and ID 1 to ID L. And this outputs a secure key and ciphertext. As long as the secret key of the empty string and the secret key delegated to ID 1 and the secret key delegated to ID 1, ID 2 and the secret key delegated to ID 1, ID 2, some other identities, ID L minus 1, and the secret key of ID 1, ID L, were never corrupted, but still all other secret keys in that tree can be corrupted in particular also secret keys that could be further delegated from the challenge. So this is the guarantees that we can get from HIBE, and now we want to use that for forward secure CAMs. There are two possible ways to do that. No, we will stick to one. We will talk about the other way later. Okay, so we want to build the following mechanism. We have Alice and Bob. Bob has two algorithms. The first one is the gen algorithm. And the gen algorithm of the FSCAM uses just the gen algorithm of the HIBE scheme. Okay. Then Alice has the ANC algorithm. using the public key that she just received from Bob. And the basic idea of that ANC algorithm is as follows. She starts with randomly sampling a nonce. And that nonce is basically a bit string of L bits. And now, in order to encapsulate what she's going to do, is she uses the HIBE scheme by encapsulating to the public key and the nonce. Now she sends that ciphertext to Bob. And the basic idea is, so she wants to execute the decapsulation algorithm of her FS chem. So this is, of course, the encapsulation algorithm of the hype. And now the basic idea is as follows. She has a tree of secret keys. And the first entry in that, or the first, the root of that tree, is the first secret key. Now, when she receives the first secret key, what she's going to do, when she receives the first ciphertext, what she's going to do is she will look at the nonce. Let's say the nonce is, as an example, nonce equals 01. And so on, 10. Now, in order to decapsulate that ciphertext, what she needs to do is she needs to delegate down to that, to the leaf node of the nonce. So she will first start delegating to obtain the secret key 0. Sorry, this one here is the empty string. Okay. So she will first delegate down to the secret key 0, where on the other side there is the secret key 1. And she will actually delegate both of them. Now in the second step, she will delegate to secret key 00 and secret key 01. Okay? She will continue until she reaches the secret key 01 and so on 1. And at the end, from that secret key, she will delegate again secret key 01 and so on 10 and secret key 01 and so on 11. Okay, using that secret key, she can actually decapsulate the ciphertext. Okay, so first, delegate along path of nonce. Second step is decapsulate C with resulting secret key. But as I said, she will also delegate all the siblings on that path, which is the so-called co-path. So she will, three, delegate co-path of nonce. And she will store these three secret keys. Not all of them below those, but the first sibling on this binary tree of the nonce path that we just used for decapsulation. And the fourth step, orange isn't the best idea, but whatever. Is there a better red? Let's use this one here. So the fourth step is remove secret keys on nonce path. So she will remove all these secret keys. Remember only secret keys on co-path. And so the basic idea is the new secret key, FS Chem, is the collection of co-path secret keys in the HIBE tree. Via delegation. This means that the secret key is not of constant size. The secret key grows with the first step. With multiple steps, yeah. Secret key grows. And so the basic idea is our security guarantee, or our idea was, for everything that was already decapsulated, the secret key does not reveal information on those keys anymore, only for future keys. And our construction is achieving this as follows. It starts with the original HIBE secret key. Once we decrypted something, we first delegate to that secret key, use that secret key to decapsulate, And then we remove this secret key to make sure that this secret key can never be delegated again. But we have to make sure that all the other ciphertext can still be decapsulated. And for that reason, we keep all the information that is necessary to reach all the other nodes in the tree, except for the node that we just used. And for that reason, we keep in mind all the secret keys that are on the copath of the path that we just used for decapsulation. Yeah, and I think an execution of how this works in practice for a simple example will be the first step that we do in the next lecture. But we still have minus 1 minute for questions. So any question? And thank you actually for giving me 5 minutes more than I actually had. Thank you for your attention. We see each other next week. There is an exercise for next week. And the exercise introduces us into how to avoid inefficient HIBE by using interactive key exchange. We will have the security proof that the scheme that we had for our exercise today actually achieves RCCA security definition. And we look at Al-Gamal public key encryption with a slightly evolved notion or with a slightly evolved construction compared to what we had in the first lecture. And this is basically the homework for next week. Thank you very much for your attention. See you.